from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Welcome to We the People. This is the hour where race, politics, history, and culture intersect right here at WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org, bringing you jazz and justice for over 47 years. We are a Pacific radio station based in Washington, D.C., but most importantly, supported by you, the listener, in our financial entirety, which means I'm taking time out to thank you for your recent support for our spring pledge drive. It is always good to be connected as we try to build one community, one broadcast at a time. Our guest today is Alice Randall. Ms. Randall is a best-selling novelist, an award-winning songwriter and educator, widely recognized and a significant voice in modern Black fiction. She's also an innovative food activist committed to the reforms that support healthy bodies and healthy communities. She lives in Nashville, and where she writes country music songs, and also is the Andrew Mellon Professor of Humanities, Professor of African and Diaspora Studies, and writer in residence at Vanderbilt University. Our topic, which is from the basis of her book, My Black Country, A Journey Through Country Music's Black Past, Present, and Future. Ms. Randall, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
David, it is a pleasure to be with you. This is a revered radio show on a revered station, and I am truly thrilled to make it a stop in the introduction of My Black Country to the world.
And thank you. Thank you for that. You're referring to making a stop here with us, but you're not a stranger to Washington, D.C. You've spent a good portion of your life here, so we welcome you back, and we welcome you back in celebration.
I mentioned
in your biography that you're a best-selling writer. You shook the literary world with, dare I say it, a spoof of Gone with the Wind called The Wind on Gone. Subsequently, you came out with many other books, Black Bottom Saints, Detroiters were shouting out to you, and a number of other works as well. So you already get a hat tip from me for the work you've done through your writing. But now we turn our attention to country music. And so I will just begin with the basics, as I always do. What is country music? And then distinctively, what is Black country music?
Well, everyone's talking about that this summer of the Beyoncé moment, that when you read this book, you're going to come to see it's a movement. But first of all country music is Black country music. Country music is an Afro-Celtic form, and it is a hidden treasure trove of Black genius, though it is many other things, some of them negative too. But the simplest formula to me of what is country music is it is English, Irish, Scottish ballad forms, plus Black influences, plus evangelical Christianity. And the answer of what is Black country music is the best country music, Black country music, starting with Ray Charles, Modern Sounds and Country and Western, going right up to Cowboy Carter. But Black country music is the country music where the Black genius is forefronted and known, not hidden. That's often because the artist, acknowledged artist, is Black, or because it is centered on a Black instrument, such as the banjo, or because Black audience has adopted it and made it their own. So that's what is Black country music.
And I'm up there in years, but among friends younger and older, if we heard a country music song, one of us would go, aha, backing vocals, Black women. And so there's this sense of, if not exploitation, a drawing on the talents of Black folk. But there's also the tragedy of the disappearance, which we've alluded to. And then, of course, and I love your initial answer, because we can fight beyond the stereotypical boxes now and just talk as if it's natural and organic. We're people, too. We're here doing country music.
And we have been erased. I do want to acknowledge you are so right. There has been what I call cultural redlining. There has been erasure. I want to say right here and now, the first million-selling country song was something called Blue Yodel, number 9. That was 1930. The person who got credit for that was Jimmy Rogers, a white man. But there were three geniuses on that album and two on that record, and two of them were Black. One was Mr. Louis Armstrong, and the other was Lil Hardin Armstrong. Two Black geniuses, Lil Hardin from Fisk University, played on every bar of that record.
And we'll find out even a little bit more about her and influence on country music. Before we get into that, I was trying to set up something that I noticed of great beauty in your book. Country music represents emotional mileposts, touch points, sometimes even fuel an engine through your life's journey. Can you explain that to our listeners, please?
I was born in Detroit in 1959, the same year and place as Motown Records. And I say that my mother, my grandmother, and my aunt, the three most important women in my family, only had one thing in common. And it wasn't loving me, because my mama didn't. It was loving country music. So number one, country music was important to me because the Black women in my family, who had roots in the rural South, all loved a new country, different country, but they knew it. But I've also said, I just mentioned that my mother did not love me. Country has some abiding themes, and one of those themes is life is hard. God is real. The road, family, and liquor are significant compensations, and the past is better than the present. All of those themes meant a lot to me from childhood to our. Life is hard because of that mama. God is real because of my Lutheran Black and Black Baptist. My grandmother's Black Baptist church and my mother's Black Lutheran church, I knew God was real. Family is compensation, I knew the road. And the past that was better than the present for me was the Motown past better than the Washington, D.C. present? After I got kidnapped from my mama, by my mama, and brought from Motown to Washington, D.C. So all the big themes of country, starting with life is hard, were very real to me. And I love the hope in country. I teasingly said with my mother, you know, that old blues song, sometimes I feel like a motherless child a long way from home. I couldn't understand that song as a child because that sounded like a good thing, a safe thing to be a motherless child far from home. So the blues was too sad for me. I need all the hope in country. I love Welcome Table, that gospel song that influences country. I'm going to tell Jesus how you done me. I like that.
Dare I say, after reading the book, the sense of hope was conveyed by each of you, at least two out of the three of your relatives. Could you just explain that a little bit more to people? What songs were you sung to? What rituals did you do around country music?
Well, my grandmother dear, who was born near Selma, Alabama in the 19th century, she was born in 1898. She used to sing to me on her lap, "Will the circle be unbroken?" She used to sing to me, "She'll be coming around the mountain." And one of the wild and sad and complicated stories in our family's life, my grandmother lost two children, two sons. Her firstborn, she buried two sons, her firstborn and the youngest, the baby, in a house fire when the fire department wouldn't come as quick to the Black families in Detroit as they did in some other neighborhoods. And she told me the story of the funeral. And I could never even tell which son's funeral it was because in her grief, they had shattered and refractured and they were both. But in one, the coffin fell out of the back of the hearse. She is in the first car of mourners. And so the car she's in almost touches the coffin of her dead son in the road. And when she told me that story, she said, it was like he was jumping up out of his hearse to love her one last time. She let it be that. For a moment, it was when she thought things could not be worse. Her child's body is falling into the road and the coffin is splintering. And then she let it be this country music thing that he knew he was loved. She knew he died loved. She knew he was loved. And this was him signing love to her one last time. And that is embodied, lived country music.
Incredible. So even though that has the intimacy of family life, that pushes you outward so you can take your own steps into the world. And part of that that seems natural early on is you have a wonderful curiosity to find out history and backstories. We mentioned a little bit earlier about erasure and disappearance. I want to say outrightly for the benefit of our listeners, you know, the name DeFord Bailey or Lil Hardin or Esley Riddle, these are not common names. And you even talked about a song, "Will the Circle Be Unbroken?" And if I'm not mistaken, that was popularized by the Carter family. But there's a whole backstory to the Black personas, the Black people that inhabit Black country.
Absolutely. As my father said in the simplest way, and he only went to one semester of college, how often you bet traditional was a color gal, that a lot of these traditional songs, traditional folk songs, traditional blues songs in America were written by unacknowledged Black people. But the people you've just mentioned, DeFord Bailey, was a third generation. He called himself Black hillbilly singer. His grandfather, who was born in the 19th century, had been a noted musician. And DeFord will become the Opry's first star, period, not first Black star. The Opry's first...
The Grand Ole Opry's first superstar.
Was a Black man. And the first time we'll ever hear the phrase Grand Ole Opry will be on the radio in 1927. And the next sound after the announcer says those words, Grand Ole Opry, will be the sound of DeFord Bailey playing his original country song, Pan American Blues. So, and as I said, that's 1927. Lil Hardin will play on Blue Yodel Number 9 in 1930, but their names will be erased. We will all know about the Carter family, but we don't know, his name has often been erased. Esley Riddle, the man who taught the Carters so many of the songs they knew, a man who only had three fingers on one of his hands, and he played with those three fingers. And that noted Carter scratch sounds a lot like how Esley Riddle played. He had lost his fingers in a shooting accident, a potential suicide attempt after he had already lost a leg. So we know Jimmy Rogers and the Carter family had so many Black influences and Black presence in their life and on their stages and on their recordings, but these names get erased from the story.
And of course, yes,
I want to put them forward. The names I want to put forward are the real mama and papa of country, which is Dee Ford Bailey, Lil Hardin, that's the mama and the papa. As I said, Ray Charles is their genius child. He'll come out with Modern Sounds in Country and Western in 1962, 63. And we've got Charlie Pride is Dee Ford's side child, because Dee Ford will be the first Black man on the Opry. Charlie Pride will be the second. And let us not forget Herb Jeffries. He was the bronze buckaroo in the 30s and 40s. And all those wonderful Black singing cowboy records, movies and eventually records.
Yeah, Herb Jeffries, many of those movies are still available on DVD or on different streaming sources as well.
Yeah, and YouTube even. Some of them, they've gone into the public domain, so you can watch them on YouTube.
That's fantastic. These people and then some set a bedrock for country music, for Black country music. But you talk about a specific behavior or archetype. I noticed early on in the book, you talk about Black country eccentrics. What does it mean to be a Black country eccentric or eccentric within country music?
Well, the Black country eccentrics are some of my absolute favorite people in country music. One of them is Swamp Dogg. One of them is Stoney Edwards. In more recent times, we get Lil Nas X.
Talk about eccentric. Yeah.
And they relate to the Black dandy. But I say, and I don't even quote from my book, I almost know this one by heart. The eccentrics of Black country refuse to be seduced into a false sense of belonging achieved by adhering to established codes of aesthetics arising from either their home communities or the dominant culture. They're not going to be like other Black folk or white folk. By flexing their connection to a globe, not an acre, they flex their humanity, their universality, and their world making. And they then sign their own significance in the world they made. These are people who create their own rules. In one case, Swamp Dogg, for example, is on the album cover riding a giant white rat like a horse.
And this is what, in the, what time?
It's gonna be the late 60s, early 70s. I can't even tell you some of the details of the Stoney Edwards song, but going back to Swamp Dogg for a moment, he had Jimmy Cliff covered one of his and took Black Country Universal with Synthetic World. And he literally says, I come from the bayou. He calls himself country actively in the song. He says, but he said, your cities are made of wood. It's futuristic. He's talking about people being killed by their deodorant, but he's saying, I'm from the country. I'm a country boy. And I am denouncing the politics of this globe that is just being so commercial and it's wild. That's Swamp.
He's kind of the Sun Ra of country music, so to speak.
Yes. And then, as I said, and through Jimmy Cliff, he goes throughout the world. So I love these eccentric. In the more modern world, another one would be the Wooten brothers, who I've worked with a lot. Victor and Roy, I think one of them has 5 Grammys, one of them have 6. They basically reinvented bluegrass music as the Flecktones. and they create their own instruments. The one of them looks like, I thought he looked like a pirate, but actually he sort of looks like the person who's called the Black Mozart and wears a George Washington type of hat. I mean, yeah. The Wooten brothers grew up with military parents all over the world, starting off in Hawaii. But they have created their own way of being that I can just call brilliantly Wootenish.
Yeah. And again, you were naming them with Bella, playing with Bella Fleck.
Yeah.
So other artists recognize other artists. They recognize the craft and the artistry and the genius and what they do. Listeners, the Wooten Brothers, Wooten, if you're looking up Miss Randall, Alice, some of our listeners really are dutiful and they jot down notes. Let me take a moment again to reintroduce you. We're talking to Alice Randall. Her latest book, My Black Country, A Journey Through Country Music's Black Past, Present, and Future, is the basis of our book. She's lived in Washington for quite some time, but now is based in Nashville. But folks, she's back taking Washington by storm. At the time of this broadcast, tonight she'll be at the MLK Public Library. The following day, she'll be at the Library of Congress Brown Bag Lunch event. And on Friday, and a lengthy discussion with some important curators at the National Museum of African American History and Culture this Friday. If you're listening this week, this is the first broadcast. So know that you can catch her at these events by going to alicerandall.com/tour, T-O-U-R. And Alice Randall, again, one word, R-A-N-D-A-L-L. I hope you get a chance to enjoy her in person as much as I've enjoyed your book, Miss Randall. Alice, it's a wonderful book.
Thank you. And all those events are free. I just want to say they are.
Yes.
Free. And so I just can't wait to see my home folk be back in D.C.
And for longtime supporters and followers on Facebook, I will put a link up in the Facebook post so you can find these things really quickly. Again, we're talking about the uniqueness of Black country, but that is, it is country music. It's part of a whole. It's not derivative. It's unique. It contributes on its own integrity. You know, this notion, you mentioned Stoney Edwards, and I'm no expert on country, but I do know when I've heard him, and I'm trying to think, I want to say my solid rock. It's the song about really loving your partner and not going away. You couldn't get anything more cool. And you talked about his persona. One album cover, he's dressed in some really fancy black pants and a vest. And it's, there's a coolness. There's a just something that's distinct that's offered with these artists that you're mentioning. I'd like to ask, do you think Black country represents both a rural sense of things and an urban sense of things? I suspect the Great Migration plays a part in that.
Well, that is a great question, David. I appreciate you asking that. Well, I say I was born up south in Detroit, not down south, but the part of Detroit where I lived was, everybody was straight up from Alabama. So I might as well have been born in Detroit, Alabama. So yes, one thing is Black people do live all through the rural South, including in small towns and on country acres. And that's part of the lived Black experience that's reported on in country songs. But there's also Black people living up south, people from Mississippi and Chicago, people in Detroit from Alabama. And I think songs like Papa's Rolling Stone, Cloud Nine, these songs have true country elements. And that's different than the, the sweetest of the Motown songs, which are something very, very different and radical, that they embody radical joy and radical cool. They're not about life is hard and God is real. They are about something else. That's the sounds of young America. But But Cloud Nine and Papa Was a Rolling Stone, that's about life is hard and God is real. And it's much more in that territory. So I do think that country, we have to realize, is North and South, East and West. It is calling out to the fact, and let me just take you a Detroit reality, because I was born there. When I was a little kindergartner in Detroit City, we talked about A. Philip Randolph and the brotherhood of sleeping car porters all the time, even in kindergarten. He was a hero. And the person they're telling us about is Nat Love, one of the first sleeping car porters. But Nat Love, who wrote his own autobiography before he was a sleeping car porter, like many sleeping car porters, was a cowboy. Many of the original sleeping car porters were cowboys. In Nat Love's book, his autobiography, he has pictures of himself in his cowboy uniform, working clothes, and his sleeping car porter work clothes. But that's part of, unfortunately, racism in America, that we keep those images of the Black men working as sleeping car porters. And I believe in them and the fact that they were incredibly important early union people. I have every kind of pride. But why did we erase all the Black cowboys when we know 20 to 30%
yes,
cowboys were Black and brown? And I think that has to do with a story some parts of America want to talk about America, that the radically independent living with nature men in the West were white. Well, that's not true. They weren't all white. 20 to 30% were Black, including Nat Love.
Listeners.
And I love that we find in the country and Western, the Western yes, songs, a lot of those songs have their roots literally in early Black cowboy songs.
So, and we can amplify that after our break, but I want to remind listeners, you're listening to We the People right here on your Jazz and Justice radio station, WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. We're at the halfway point in our show, and as a service to our listeners, we're going to take a brief break for public service announcements, but stick with us. We'll hear more from Alice Randall and My Black Country. Our focus in this hour, Black country music. We'll be back right after this. Thank you.
Blues Alley is opening its doors to WPFW for two benefit shows on Wednesday, November 20th. DC's Great Guitars will feature three generations of players, Anthony Pirog and his wife and collaborator Janelle Lapine, Telecaster player David W. Chappell, and elder statesman Rick Whitehead, all playing solos, duets, and together in a full group. That's Wednesday, November 20th, two shows at 7 and 9:30. Ticket information is available at bluesalley.com/events.
Welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. But most importantly, please focus on my guest, Alice Randall. We're here talking about Black country music. The basis of our conversation is her latest book, My Black Country, A Journey Through Country Music's Black Past, Present, and Future. Alice Randall is not only a country music songwriter, but she's accomplished herself in modern literature with works like The Wind Done Gone. And listeners, if you listen carefully, you can guess what that's spoofing. And she also teaches and is a professor and writer in residence at Vanderbilt University. Obviously, her base is Nashville. Again, Alex Randall, thank you for being with us. It's so important that we celebrate you and your time here in Washington, D.C. I announced earlier that people can go to Alice Randall, one word, and Randall spelled RANDALL.com/tour. And know that later this evening, you'll be at the Martin Luther King branch, the main branch of the DC Public Library. Tomorrow, you'll be at the Library of Congress for the Brown Bag Lunch program that they have. And importantly, there'll be an extended conversation with you by, I believe, two curators at the National Museum of African American History and Culture Friday evening. All those events are free. I would advise people to look them up. I know the NMAC, the Friday event, it's good to pre-register for that event. And again, we're talking about really deep roots of country music, the deep rootedness of Black folk here in the United States. It's manifested in all sorts of ways, in literature, in the arts, in vocations and achievements, but particularly in country music. There is Black country music. Black country music is country music. And I thank you for that affirmation. Before we went on break, we were talking about just how Black country music displays history a lot, but it also displays place. And we've talked about that wherever you've been, country music has some tie. So I wanted to take time out since we're emanating from Washington, D.C. What was the country music experiences that you had here in D.C.? And may I say, you spent most of this time in high school and coming out of high school.
Well, I was in D.C. from the end of third grade. I arrived just before the assassination of Martin Luther King, and I graduated in high school in 1977. And, you know, the traditional country music I heard was the bluegrass that often people associate with Washington, D.C., the seldom seen, the country gentleman. But the country music that I heard that was most important to me in D.C. was Roberta Flack singing First Time Ever, I Saw Your Face.
And I can imagine people looking bewildered, but I know you can explain that quite well, as I read it in your book. Go ahead, please.
Well, one, it is a storytelling. It's two, it's really, I think, about as much about, it's Afro-Celtic. It is written by an Irish writer. It has Roberta Flack bringing her church gospel sound, which is not the evangelical sound, but a very different, her church sound to it.
And kind of like Methodist hymnology.
You know? Yes. And there's some wonderful, interesting theorists who've written about that. And I talk about it. And it completely reminded me of the story my father told me about the first time he ever saw me when I was a baby. So it reminded me of the past being better than the present. The past when I was with my daddy and he was just first time he ever saw my face. When I heard that song right on time, it brought back to me my Black daddy's Black family audacious love. And it is, I said, Afro-Celtic, past is better than the present, and it's got some kind of evangelical Christianity in it. It's all kinds of country. And so that was a country song that I loved hearing then. I also heard in DC, spending some summer weekends at a place called Fishing Creek on the Maryland shore. One of my friend's family members were always watching Johnny Cash. And on the Johnny Cash show, I saw some old friends and new. But in this time period, you know, I'm hearing the great Bill Withers, who I think is a country artist, and his grandpapa was a Black coal miner in West Virginia. But I'm hearing O.C. Smith. I'm hearing a lot of cool Black country, some of it coming from the Johnny Cash show, some of it coming from albums. And I'm hearing all that, you know, the Allman Brothers and the kind of hippy-dippy country rock that you get to hear as a Black girl in an integrated private school in Washington, D.C. So was part
and
of
it. Just quickly, you mentioned the Allman Brothers and Johnny Cash. Both of those gentlemen had significant interactions with Black folk and Black culture. I'm making that an open-ended comment in case you want to add to that. Are there?
Well, one of the things that fascinated me is one of my mentors when I first got to Nashville is a man called Cossie Gardner. And Cossie was a Black man who came out of a Black Nashville funeral fortune and learned to play the organ in his daddy's funeral parlor. And he was the leading organist. He played with Chet Atkins and all kinds of people on RCA Records, but he was the leading organist in Nashville. He's about 7 years older than Greg and Dwayne Allman. People don't know they were born in Nashville. And when Greg and Dwayne Allman were just starting out, literally, they had the exact same manager as Cossie Gardner, who's 7, 8 years ahead of them and is the number one organist in all of Nashville. And I think basically in Greg Allman's organ, what's so amazing about it is it sounds like funeral parlor organ, not ballpark organ. If you listen to the Come On Baby Light My Fire at the Doors, that's a version of ballpark organ.
M&B3 action, yeah. No?
But the way Greg Allman played is very, very Black. And it's very Black funeral parlor to me. And I think he learned that from Cossie. I asked Cossie that question. He didn't answer it directly. He said, I claim you. He wasn't claiming, he was very, but he didn't deny it either. So there it is.
Well,
and Johnny Cash, of course, as we now know, his first wife
was Black.
And he gave me a start when I first came to Nashville and trying to support myself and start writing and publishing. I was a PA and a wrangler in a video called The Chicken in Black, and it was being filmed in the Ryman Auditorium, at least in part, and I was in the basement with Roy Orbison. You have to read the book to get the whole story, but I got pecked by a trained chicken and ran out of there, sitting on the sidewalk, and ran straight into the godmother of the Prince of Black Nashville. And the father of my first child. And I would get married to him in St. John's Lafayette Square because he was a Black Foreign Service person.
Wow. And again, just in case that zipped by people. Yeah, there was a chicken. There was a video that was involving a chicken, Johnny Cash and Roy Orbison. And you'll have to look into my Black country to find out more about what went on with all that. Just moving really quickly, I alluded in the first half of the show that you're well-traveled. And coming out of high school, you spent time over in England and in Cambridge. What was that experience on particularly fishing for? You mentioning some of the 5 points you learned. You don't have to mention all five, but at least mention some of the big things you learned from that experience. And how in the world did it relate to country?
Well, you know, it's funny that I am not that you tell me one and I'll give you the other ones. I'm wondering what you're going for. One that what I learned at Harvard was I started thinking about American metaphysical poetry. So I started learning that American people said metaphysical poetry was dead. The British metaphysicals, the American metaphysicals.
So and William Blake, I'm trying to think, Samuel Coleridge.
Exactly, the Edward Taylor, that I discovered that actually metaphysical poetry was alive and well and hiding in country music. So these extended metaphors, which we find in 16 Carriages, that we find in Cowboy Carter, that we find in an old country song, Drop Kick Me Jesus Through the Goalpost of Life, that I love an extended metaphysical poetry image that we find all through Black country and we find through country. And so, and some of that is coming, that metaphorical language is coming out of Black folks because my father never went to school until he went to high school in Detroit, coming out of Selma. And he loved Shakespeare almost immediately. And Shakespeare's coming right from that similar period. And I said, how did you go from not reading and writing to Shakespeare? He said, it sounded a lot like the King James Bible to me. And that's exactly how he went there. That Black people in the South were raised on the sounds of the King James Bible. And so they're getting some of this old English language here and taking it with them into their music forms, into our music forms, into country music.
Okay. And I think that's good enough. You've combined the basic point. I think the other thing, if I've got my chronology from your book correct, this is a time where you begin to run into some important connections that support you
in
your pursuit that you knew, at least in high school, that you were going to pursue this country music. And basically, yeah, as a songwriter, can you explain that to the audience?
As a songwriter and a publisher. So what I learned in Cambridge, or the assets that I got in Cambridge, was one, I met a lady who decided that she wanted to invest in my country music publishing company, because I knew publishing was the way to make money in it, because I was born in Detroit. I knew Anna Gordy had a record label before Berry Gordy, so I knew about publishing.
You knew about Sylvia Robinson also with Sugar Hill Records.
Absolutely.
So you know that women are powerful and can move in the music industry.
Exactly. And I knew about women songwriters. So I was following that business model. I found an investor. My college roommate, Emily's mother, who couldn't get a job after graduating from Yale Law School. She was one of the first women to graduate from Yale Law School, hardly could get a job. People were offering her jobs as secretaries in law offices. She went to ASCAP. And by the time I met Emily, she was arguably the most prominent woman in the entire music industry, because she was an executive with ASCAP collecting royalties for thousands of writers. So that opened a lot of doors for me. I found that investor. There was an album that came out, and I hate to call, I love the Smithsonian, I'll be at the Smithsonian on Friday. But about the time when I was graduating, the Smithsonian put out the Smithsonian Collection of Country Classics, and it did not have D4 Bailey in it, did not have the Black Singing Cowboys. It had Mr. Charlie Pride, did not have the Pointer Sisters. Basically, Black genius was excluded from that. And that made me determined to come to Nashville and shine some light on these forgotten people.
So you caught a double signal there. In the larger, at large public conversation, well, Black people somehow influenced country music, but they weren't granted the recognition of their agency and participation. Do I have that right?
Exactly. And when this collection is made, there's nothing mentioned that the banjo is an African influence, an African instrument, that Black people developed the banjo in these Americas. We don't have that. There's no mention of Linda Martell. You know, that at that point, Fairy Tale was already a huge song.
Yeah, tell people who Linda Martell is.
Well, Linda Martell will be the first Black woman to sing on the Grand Ole Opry and to get on the country charts. She'll get in the late 60s, early 70s. She will appear on Hee Haw and play, and I think 12 times on the Opry stage. And then she will just, she's physically beautiful, has an extraordinary voice and amazing song sense. Great. Think Black Lynn Anderson. You know, she's so beautiful. She's so interesting. And she gets no traction. They put her on a label called Plantation Label.
Oh my goodness.
That was not a legacy name. They created a new label, signed her to it, and they name it Plantation. But that woman, who is still alive, and I am thrilled that Beyonce put her on her album, Cowboy Carter. Mm-hmm. She will be the only Black woman on the country charts until 2006, 2007, when Recy Palmer enters the charts. There'll be all the 70s, 80s, 90s, most of the aughts, until we get 40 years later, we get Recy Palmer. So that's what's extraordinary about this Black country moment right now. That when I arrived in Nashville in 1983, Charlie Pride had already been 29 times to the number one spot. But no Black woman had got to number one until now.
Mentioned Charlie Pride. Isn't he the first Black artist at the Grand Ole Opry since DeFord Bailey? Isn't there a gap of decades?
Decades. He's also the first Black person to become Entertainer of the Year in 71, but there is a gap of decades. DeFord was pushed off the Opry in the 40s. Once he's pushed off, the 50s, the 60s go by. We have decades, and then we get Charlie Pride. But he did have absolutely, you know, it's one of the greatest country artists of all time, period, exclamation point.
Listeners, I just want to remind you that the voice you're hearing is that of Alice Randall. We're talking from the basis of her book, My Black Country, a journey through country music's Black past, present, and future. And she's a widely recognized best-selling novelist and an award-winning songwriter and educator. And most importantly, she's sharing with us a great wealth of history and her own personal experience in the world of country music and Black country music in particular. The two are not apart. We've been talking about how intimate, how closely integral each is for the other. And I'm mindful that we're running out of time. I'm also going to say that My Black Country has a album presentation from Oh Boy Records that has various artists. So let's kind of go rapidly. Since I've mentioned the album, what do you want to tell us about it? Particularly tell us about the artists who are on it and doing the recording for that.
Well, they are some of the most extraordinary Black and Brown women working in country music. We've got Layla Michaela. Mm-hmm. We've got Sister String, Shantae and Monique Ross, Edia Victoria, Rhiannon Giddens, Sunny Moore, Miko Marks, Allison Russell, Sania. We also have
your daughter is on that album too.
My daughter Caroline, Valerie June, and let us not forget Reese Palmer. But what's wild is they're all singing songs that have been recorded previously. My songs I wrote that have been recorded by people like Glenn Campbell and Marie Osmond.
Well, I'm holding back. Let me interrupt you. You wrote X's and O's for Trisha Yearwood.
2 weeks at number
one.
That
was a monster hit in the country music world.
It was a monster hit. It is a reoccurrent standard. 30 years later, song is 30 years old this year, and it's still huge.
And but I don't mean to embarrass you, on your song publishing side, hubby Garth Brooks is an important part of your professional achievements.
Absolutely helped launch. Did a little bit of launch in that career of Garth Brooks. So I came to Nashville in 83 to be a country songwriter and publisher, and I was a successful country songwriter and publisher. And that also made me, I was here for 41 years, another person, Black person, written out of the story. Up until this year, I don't think anyone had noticed that I had had songs recorded in the 80s, 90s, aughts, 10s, and now the 20s. But I'm thankful, David, that you and other journalists and a large Black audience and these amazing singers that I've just told you about, Rhiannon, Reese, Adia, Sister Strings, my own daughter, have come led by Ebony Smith, a brilliant Black woman out of Memphis, Tennessee, riding to the rescue of my legacy, to put Black voices on the song so the song sounded like I imagined them, but also so it makes it easier for the listeners to know that the sheroes and heroes in my songs were Black people.
And so they remain, and so they will be. There are a lot of important appearances in your book. I want to tease people to pick their interest because I believe you've done the grand service of getting people not only interested and engaged in Black country music, but to truly enjoy it and to see how it fits our roots. Quincy Jones is important person in your life. Maya Angelou.
I put her in a Reba McEntire video of the year.
Yeah.
She loved country. Yeah.
And so, Charlie Parker loved country. Billy
and
Preston
Prince,
loved country.
Prince yeah. mentored Reese. That's one of the things I share in the
yes.
book.
Okay.
As a country artist.
In the few minutes we have, I know it's important for you as a writer, but in this practice of spending your life's time with country music, it's not just about getting up and singing. It's about the publishing, the songwriting, the interactions, the routines of writing. Do you want to make some sort of statement about craft and writing in this whole world that you're mixed up in?
I say you make same like you make a bed every day, and you work on the craft of writing to be ready every day. That it's not just when the inspiration hits you. One of the things that I always did was, when I first came here, was to hear all 100 songs that were on the country charts and write them down and analyze them and study them. I also study and analyze classic country as much to see what has been done so I could do something that had never been done, as it wasn't so much I could follow the leader, but to see what the gaps are, to recognize we didn't have a song about lynching and we needed one to tell that witness, speak that witness. So it is it's a big discipline. You look for subjects, you look at alternative titles, you structure and restructure so many steps along the way. Some of my titles, I had a lot of cowboy songs because I was very interested in amplifying the reality of Black cowboys. So Girls Ride Horses 2 is one of my songs. Went for a Ride is another cowboy song. Ballad of Nat Love, not on this album, it's another. I have quite a few of these cowboy songs, and then songs that talk about what Black women's rural lives are like. Small towns are smaller for girls.
Well, we mentioned a number of people, particularly Beyonce and Lil Nas X, but what do you want to say about the future? You seem to have laid a foundation, a bedrock for the future. I'm sure your energy, not only reflected in this book, in part guarantees us a future that involves Black country music.
I'm so excited about new voices. On this album, we have Sania, who was born here in Nashville. I think she and Ebony are thinking about doing a whole country album for her. Valerie June, I think, is a very important voice. Rhiannon Giddens, extraordinary. Yeah,
of Carolina Chocolate Drops.
Exactly.
And a young lady from Baltimore, and in this split second moment, I can't think of her name, who's a country music artist.
I'm not sure which one's from Baltimore. I'm going to go here in Nashville tonight, Brittany Spencer, country artist. We have so many. And of course, on the male side, I want to shout out Breland, who's now calling me his new nephew. And I am very proud to be Breland's Auntie Alice. So I think that we have a great future of Black country. And I think it's a day that Lil Hardin and D4 Bailey, unfortunately, did not get to live to see, but all the artists working now, including me, have benefited from their legacy. And all these new lights now shine a light back on this country as a treasure trove of hidden Black genius. And I think the name of your show is
We the People.
We the People. That is such an American idea, who we the people are, and understanding that country is Black is part of understanding that America is Black, and that also indigenous and white, that if this country, country music owes this much to Black aesthetics at its best, how much more does every other thing in America owe to Black aesthetics, Black experience, Black ideologies?
Alice Randall, we thank you for being with us. And it's Brittany Spencer, who's from Baltimore.
That's who I'm hearing tonight, Brittany Spencer.
Yes.
Did I say Brittany Spencer?
Yes, we want to mention her name. Baltimore listeners are always kind to me, so I want to do the right shout out. Again, Alex Randall, thank you so, so much for all your work in producing My Black Country, A Journey Through Country Music's Black Past, Present, and Future.
Hope Again. To see you, some of my fellow DC folks, in the next few days. Take care.
All right then, take care. We'll be right back.
make us cry. And in the name of brotherhood, the rivers run dry. We shall not stand down. We'll not be your clown.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Scott Bamba. The United States and some other Western embassies in Kyiv are staying closed today for security reasons, with the American delegation saying it has received a warning of a potentially significant Russian air attack on the Ukrainian capital. The precautionary step came after Russian officials promised a response to President Joe Biden's decision to let Ukraine strike targets on Russian soil with U.S.-made longer-range missiles, a move that angered the Kremlin. The U.S. Embassy said its closure and attack warnings were issued in the context of ongoing Russian missile and drone attacks on Kyiv and anticipated a quick return to regular operations. U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein says an agreement to end the Israel-Hezbollah war is, quote, within our grasp after meeting officials in Lebanon. It's unclear how close they are to an agreement which would likely entail both the militants and Israeli ground forces withdrawing from a U.N. buffer zone in southern Lebanon. Time is running short for negotiators at the United Nations climate talks in Azerbaijan to solve a difficult puzzle. They need to find an agreement that can bring far more money to poor nations affected by climate change than wealthy nations have shown they are willing to pay. Many climate activists question the siting of this year's talks in oil and gas-rich Azerbaijan, whose president has described those fossil fuels as a, quote, gift of the gods. Former Hong Kong publisher Jimmy Lai is testifying in his defense at his landmark national security trial, which is widely seen as a measure of press freedom and judicial independence in Hong Kong. Charles de Ledesma reports.
People wait outside the court in early morning rain to secure a seat in the courtroom. Lai is the founder of the now-shuttered Apple Daily pro-democracy newspaper. He was arrested in 2020 during a crackdown on mass pro-democracy protests that rocked Hong Kong starting in 2019. He's fighting charges of colluding with foreign forces to endanger national security and conspiring with others to issue seditious publications. If convicted, he faces up to life in prison. Authorities have used a Beijing-imposed national security law to prosecute many of the city's leading activists, including Lai and 45 other democracy advocates who were sentenced on Tuesday. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
As the nominations roll in, President-elect Donald Trump is clearly prizing experience on television as he chooses people to serve in his new administration. Ben Thomas filed this report.
I'm not going to fade into the woodwork. You'll probably see me around.
Linda McMahon in 2010 after the first of her two failed bids for a Senate seat from Connecticut. President-elect Trump's now nominating the billionaire professional wrestling mogul for Secretary of Education. She served a year on the Connecticut Board of Education and on the Board of Trustees for Sacred Heart University, though she's seen as a relative unknown in education circles. She has expressed support for charter schools and school choice, but the Education Department is an agency Trump has promised to dismantle. McMahon's co-chaired Trump's transition team with Howard Lutnick, chief executive of financial services company Cantor Fitzgerald, who he's tapped to lead the Commerce Department. Trump's also selected Dr. Mehmet Oz, the former heart surgeon turned TV talk show host, to head the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Ben Thomas, Washington.
A major storm is sweeping across the northwest United States, battering the region with strong winds and rain. It caused widespread power outages and downed trees that killed at least one person. Jennifer King has more.
A bomb cyclone hitting the Pacific coast from Northern California up to British Columbia has left hundreds of thousands of people without power. Authorities are asking residents to stay off the roads after gale force winds downed trees and power lines. In Issaquah, east of Seattle, Como News talked with Wendy Harrington after a cedar tree fell on her house.
It felt explosive or like there was a bomb going off, breaking glass, the sound of breaking glass. Everything was just very loud. I thought the whole wall was coming down.
In Linwood, Washington, South County Fire reports a woman in her 50s died when a large tree fell on a homeless encampment. In Seattle, a city bus was hit by a tree. And in northeast Seattle, the fire department used chainsaws to rescue a person trapped when their car was crushed by a